Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to a podcast from CelticUnderground.net. I'm Harry Brady and this is podcast number 210A. One of my favourite phrases is that there are three sides to every story. There's your side, there's my side, and the truth is somewhere in between. Probably never more the case with Jock Brown's time as general manager at Celtic. Jock was appointed by Fergus following the departure of Tommy Burns to create a buffer between the manager and the first team coach. He was in place from June 1997 through to January 1998, famously overseeing the period where Wim Jansen and Muddy McLeod were at the club. Obviously, lots of people have various takes on that appointment, so it's probably best to hear it from the horse's mouth. Jock spent quite a good bit of time with me, so I know that a lot of people like their podcast to be just three quarters of an hour or there or thereabouts, so I've decided to split it into two podcasts. This is podcast number 210A, therefore. 210B will be along shortly. So this is me, Harry Brady, with him, Jock Brown. I am joined now by the famous, infamous general manager of Celtic, Jock Brown. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Yeah.
So, as we approach the 20th anniversary of Fergus, I thought it appropriate to speak to one of the more colourful characters of the Fergus McCann tenure, and perhaps one of the characters who, or you're sitting in front of me, so one of the people, mm-hmm. who's had a different interpretation of his time at the club than some of the others. So do you want to give people an overview as to who you are and what you were doing prior to walking in the door at Celtic?
Well, what I was doing before I walked in the door was acting as a lawyer, which I had been for a long time before that. And when I did the football commentary, I always did it on a part-time basis. It was a weekend pursuit for me, a very important weekend pursuit, one I took very seriously and tried very hard to do as well as I could. But Monday to Friday, generally speaking, I was a partner in a law firm. That took up the bulk of my time.
Okay, so Fergus had come in March 1994, dismissed Luigi Macari shortly afterwards, to use his full name as Fergus used to do, and then Tommy Burns had come in. Tommy Burns had Celtic playing fantastic football.
Correct.
We won the cup, didn't win the league, and there was lots of talk of an uneasy relationship between Fergus and Tommy Burns. Did you get any feedback of that?
Oh yeah, there was. In fact, when I first spoke to Fergus about going in my role in that conversation, he said, what about head coach, and have you any thoughts about head coach? And I said, yeah, get Tommy Burns back. And one of my great sadnesses about it is that Tommy and Billy Stark were not there at the time I was there, because I really believe firmly that had I been there to buffer Tommy and Fergus, it would have worked. Mm-hmm. Because I got on really well with Tommy and with Billy Stark, smashing guys, both of them. You're right, they played great stuff. But Tommy, as a smashing football coach, appeared to have no idea how to handle a board of directors, and certainly how to handle a chairman like Fergus, and that created umpteen clashes, about which I heard later. And when I pled his case, first thing I did was say, Tommy, I'll work with Tommy happily. Fergus just told me that, no, it's impossible, I can't do that. And I said to him, well, what's wrong with Tommy Burns? He's a great coach and great football getting played. And he then explained to me the areas he had difficulty with Tommy mm-hmm. over. And they were irreconcilable, sadly, because I wish like mad that if I met Tommy and Billy at Largs just shortly after I was going to Celtic, and I was extremely sad. I spoke to him, I said to him, it really broke my heart, the fact that we hadn't managed to all be there at the same time.
So Tommy moved on, and you had a very, very, very wide-ranging role and title.
Yeah, the role, the problem I had without doubt was the job description, the job spec, which I was never comfortable with, and I debated, if I almost didn't take the job because of that. And the biggest thing that I didn't like about it was I was told, you are in charge of the football department. You are going to be overall, so you're the head coach is to be answerable to you, which I didn't think was right. And I never played it that way. But the biggest thing that was a problem was, he said, we do not want the head coach doing any media work except pre- and post-match interviews. Everything else media-wise has to be done by you. And I said, that will not be acceptable. That won't work and it won't be acceptable, because what the media want to hear about or hear from, who they want to hear from, is the guy who picks the team, the guy who identifies the transfer targets. That's the guy they want to talk to and have access to. And if I am put up instead of that person, I'll be seen to be the guy obstructing that relationship, and I can't work, and I will be targeted for sure. The other part of the job spec that I knew was going to cause me a massive difficulty, but I did tell Fergus when I went at first, it can't last more than 2 years on that job spec. It's impossible to last more than 2 years. And one of the things was, they said to me that we really want a professional approach taken so that there are no leaks out of this club. We're fed up reading the tabloid press stuff the board don't even know, because the place leaks like a sieve. And it did. Mm-hmm. And that was well established and well known. And it was made a very important part of my role to change that and stop that. And I said, well, I think I can do that, but it'll be a massive cost, namely me, because I'll be the victim if that happens. And they said, no, that's a really important element of the job. So I said, well, if we can rethink the possibility that you can change the head coach's relationship with the press so he can speak more, and I'm not the spokesperson all the time, that might make it possible. But if you want me to do both these things, there's one casualty in short order, for sure. And I believed wrongly that I could go in there and persuade Fergus when I was in to change that. And of course I was wrong, because you don't persuade him things like that when he's made up his mind. Because I then had this job of sorting out the leaks, which I managed to do. Because if you recall, when Wim Jansen was announced and when Joseph Benglos was announced, the press conference was booked for 3:30 in the afternoon, whatever time it was, and nobody knew who would walk into that room.
Well, famously, Hugh Keevans thought it would be Arthur George.
Absolutely, no, that's right. You never forgave me for that, yeah. But now, and once the board thought that was fantastic, they absolutely were overjoyed with that. And I said, no, sorry guys, we will reap what we sow here. This will come back to haunt. It's exactly the wrong way to do it. I mean, it's great in a sense that you're able to keep things so tight. That's not the sort of thing we should keep tight. Other things we should keep tight, and we managed to do that. And the way to sort out leaks, as you probably know, is to identify the leaks. And how do you identify the leaks? Well, you tell somebody complete nonsense, only one person, that lot of nonsense. If you read the paper, you know where it came from. And I did that, and I found out where. And then once you found the leaks, you stop the supply. Mm-hmm. And once you stop the supply, not only does the source become very upset, but his masters that are paying him, no doubt, or whatever, become upset as well. So they've got to get a target, and you're the Aunt Sally, and that's it. You've got to take that. So yeah, well, you understand that. You say, well, am I going to risk that? Am I going to do that? Am I not going to do that? And I have to weigh it up and say, right, it's a two-year task, this at the most, on the way it's prescribed. I'm going to get pilloried. How much do I want to do the job? And I did want to do the job. And the enthusiasm to do the job overcame a good sense of realising it could work in terms of lasting a long time, and also overestimated my capacity to try and persuade Fergus to change things once we're in. So that was the basic picture.
One of the things you touched on there, you mentioned twice the ability to deal with Fergus. Fergus McCann, I think he's great.
Mm-hmm. So do I, yeah.
Yeah. But I've always wondered whether he was the type of person that I really admire, but I don't know if I could have worked for him.
No, honestly, working for him or with him was much more of a joy than anything else.
Right.
No hesitation in saying that. I couldn't persuade him to change that media thing. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't have that. I had to live with that, and I eventually realised that he's a soldier on and take it for the length of time it lasts. But in every other way, working with him was great because he's straight as a die, mm-hmm. says to you straight to your face exactly what he thinks, expects you to do the same back, mm-hmm. will have a stand-up argument, even a shouting match, and never carry a grudge. Mm-hmm. He expects you to say exactly what you think and to argue your corner as much as you possibly can. And you knew there was no way he was saying to you behind my back, "Well, Brownie's done that." You knew that would never be the case. If he had something to say to me, he looked me in the eye and told me that, and I knew that. And he expected me to do that to him, and I did. And on that basis, the relationship was very strong and remains very strong. I spoke to him last week. Remains strong to this day because of that mutual respect. There was no way. I said to him when I was first talking to him, I said, "Are you sure? Your reputation goes before you. You know, you're supposed to be a very difficult man, hard to work with." And he said, "Well, what makes you think that?" I said, "Well, that's the way you're portrayed. I know that could be wrong, but it's portrayed that way." I said, "If you want some quiet yes man to be stand up in front and take the flak and just agree with you, you say you've got the wrong guy, I won't do that." And he said, "I don't want yes men anywhere near the place." He said, "I want people to argue with me." We used to have a management meeting every Monday morning. Six people in the room, a senior management meeting, and discussing what happened and what was about to happen, whatever. And I can assure you, nobody sat in that room. None of the six was in any way inhibited from saying exactly what they thought. Now, you knew full well the final decision would rest with him, mm-hmm. but you couldn't half argue your corner. And there are many occasions when he came in with a fixed notion and had it changed at the meeting. Now, when you know you're not wasting your time expressing mm-hmm. your opinions, you know you're not going to win every argument, but you're going to have a say, and he's going to listen to you and treat it with some respect and come to a conclusion at the end of the day. When you know all that, then going to work with him was fine. There was nothing sinister, sly, untoward about dealing with him at all.
Now, if I stick on the Fergus stuff for a minute.
Yeah.
And your role, first of all. Mm-hmm. A lot of what Fergus talked about at the time, you know, the finances of Scottish football and the way Scottish football was run, he was pretty much pilloried. Now, we'll talk about the press side of things with you and Fergus mm-hmm. in a minute. Mm-hmm. But for me, the role of general manager was part of that element of it was just the opposite of the way everything in Scottish and British football was being done.
Yeah, just about, yeah.
Do you think that's what made your role difficult? It was nothing like anybody was used to?
Yes, it did make it difficult because it wasn't... nobody actually, in the media sense, appeared to apply his mind to exactly what was involved. I never had any interview or meeting where people analysed it in any great detail. And what they were really interested in was I interfering in the playing sense? Was I deciding what players to buy? Was I picking the team and all that kind of nonsense? And that was where they were very keen to drive a wedge wherever they possibly could. And I was punctilious about having nothing to, not even having an opinion on players mm-hmm. or anything of that kind. In fact, I can remember sitting, used to have regular meetings with Wim Janssen and I, with Wim Janssen, David Hay, Murdo McLeod, and four in the manager's room discussing players and whatever. And I can remember David Hay particularly, he's the only one of that quartet that I've got mm-hmm. a relationship with, really. But Davey, he would say, what do you think? And I said, Davey, I've not got an opinion. This is football. You guys are the pros. I'm not a pro. I'm just listening here to listen and ask some questions. I'll ask questions to test the opinions.
Yeah.
But I'm not. My opinion doesn't matter on footballers. And he said, nah, don't be daft. You've been looking at football all your life. And I said, what do you think? You know, and I said, no, sorry, I'm not going there. But he would prompt an opinion. And in fairness, I might well give it to him privately, one-to-one, at a later time. But in front of the others, I was at great pains not even to pass an opinion on football as such. Yep. But I would say, in the context of the squad we've got, do you think he is the best guy to fit in there? And is that the best decision? I remember a decision very early on about we're a central midfield player, and there were two on a short list.
Mm-hmm.
And Davey was saying, what do you think? And I said, no, I'm not going to tell you what I think, but I'm going to ask a question of you all, and I want the answer. We're playing Rangers away at Ibrox. The referee's a homer. We're one down, second half, playing against the wind, rain, all the elements. Which of these two players is more likely to turn the game our way?
Mm-hmm.
And they all said the same thing, and we signed them. Now, as it happened, I would support that decision, but it wouldn't have mattered.
Yeah.
The point was, let's assess what is it we're looking for, what is it we're trying to establish here.
Mm-hmm.
If we're choosing one or the other, and they're both about the same age and all these things, all these factors, and the cost was similar and all that kind of thing, then that seemed to be a role for me, not passing the opinion. And that was what happened.
I mean, for me, the concept that the Continentals have had for some time,
mm-hmm,
of a director in charge of the football division who creates the ethos allows you to slot in and out coaches, first team coaches.
You've got a consistency, yeah?
Yeah, because you've got, it then actually makes the tenure of first team coaches, you know, there's a lot of talk about Neil Lennon having been at Celtic now for four years. It actually makes that length of tenure unusual.
Yes.
Because you just go for the quick fix of dropping in a coach. For me, whatever the faults of the system, there appeared to be, if the media could get if Celtic had articulated it correctly, clear lines of responsibility, which, in effect, most football clubs now have,
yes,
a director of football who's a businessman, mm-hmm, and a first team coach.
Mm-hmm.
But I jokingly say that amongst Celtic fans' forums, it's unclear now who's responsible for players. So Neil Lennon signs the good ones and Peter Lawwell signs the bad ones.
Sure.
Unless people are having a hard time on Neil Lennon, then it's Neil Lennon who signs the bad ones and Peter. Do you think that most clubs now have got some sort of general manager through the chief executive, the bigger clubs?
The bigger clubs, I think that is the case. I think it's still slightly, I think we were ahead of our time at that time. I really do believe the system, in my opinion, was terrific. I would have changed that bit about the media relationship. That shouldn't be the director of football, general manager, or it shouldn't be him doing that the way we try to do it. But in every other respect, I would support that system. But I would also support the notion that there's no way in the world that the director of football or the general manager should be the guy who identifies the players to bring in, because that's not the professional expertise. Everyone's got an opinion. Everybody has an opinion about players, but you have to really keep that right under wraps when you're doing that job and listen to the pros, but test them in terms of asking the questions. One of the things I had to do is every board meeting,
mm-hmm,
monthly, whatever, I had to make a report. I had to do the football report. Now, Tommy Burns used to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, he was asked to go in and do that. Now, frankly, totally unfair to put Tommy into that environment.
Anybody who's been in business, you, the head of a division does a report to the
Absolutely.
Board.
So
but if you've never given that guy any training in business, no, report writing.
Well, you see, I had to submit in writing what the strategy was in terms of the playing side of the business, the recruitment,
mm-hmm,
sales, purchases, all of that stuff, and present a strategy. We'd do that in detail maybe every 3 months, but every month still report on what was going on, the developments to support what we tried to set out. And I pictured myself, because I would go in there and say, you're sitting there with Brian Quinn and Sir Patrick Sheehy and Fergus and people like that, you're sitting there, Eric Riley, sitting in that room, you're talking a fair intellect sitting there, mm-hmm. and you're going there to say, right, here's what we're trying to do, and make it intelligible. Now, that was a major test, a major challenge to do that, and then take and field the questions that would inevitably follow from it. Now, for a football guy like Tommy, who had never had any training in that world at all, to have to do that, and he did. Because, I mean, there were comments were made to me afterwards about, you know, how difficult Tommy had found that. But why wouldn't they have found it difficult? It was bound to be difficult for him. For me, it was an environment that wasn't that strange to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was just applying the football world to it. So I'm doing my stuff with the guys, the pros and the football sense, and putting something together and going to the business people mm-hmm. and being that makes all the sense in the world. It really does. And it's what should be perpetuated, in my opinion, in a big club. But it's still with the idea that the man in charge is the guy that identifies the players. Remember Roy Hodgson telling me the best job he had in his life was Inter Milan. Because all he did was take the bunch of players he was given, mm-hmm. take them out and coach them and train them, and go home, mm-hmm. and golf, sit on the beach. He had nothing to do with recruiting players, because there's a guy who did that. Selling players too was out of his hands. He knew that before he took the job.
Yep.
Took the job on that basis. He considered himself to be a coach, which he is, and he coached what he was given. Well, that's another way to do it. I don't like that way. I think he should have been the guy saying that I want my team missing mm-hmm. a good player in this position. This is who I think would fit the bill. Can we afford them? Have mm-hmm. we got the money to do it? I think that's how he should have worked.
So based on that, from what I'm hearing, I should be a business person and not necessarily a football person. Obviously the business person's got to understand football, but
I think that's right. I think there's got to be an understanding of the business of football mm-hmm. and an understanding of the game itself and a real feel for the game itself and an affection for the game itself and understanding of the game itself and know basically what it's about. I think you need to have that, but you still need the business side of it, I think, as well. And that's where there are lots of directors of football now that are, it might be, they say, move somebody upstairs is a great yeah. thing. You know, move them upstairs. Yeah. Make Walter Smith Rangers move upstairs to become the director of football or whatever he became. That, I don't think, is moving upstairs. It sounds like a sinecure anyway. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be. And I'm not sure that's the right way either. I think there's got to be a business element. It's a hard role to fill.
So you were, as we said earlier, the first person to do that type of role of high yep. profile, certainly in Scotland, probably mm-hmm. British football. So do you think from day one you seem to have a hard time?
Yeah.
We've all got our thoughts as to why. Do you think part of the reason might be because for a lot of people you were perceived as football commentator, so it was a guy with an interest in football, and so people were not looking at you as a lawyer mm-hmm. with a knowledge of football, but as a football commentator? And that's where people then couldn't see where they saw the ambiguity coming in.
I think there may be something. It's hard for me to speak for people in that context. I think Fergus has this theory. Mm-hmm. He has a theory, which I know he has expressed, that what happened was when I became general manager of football, a lot of guys in the media said, oh God, I never thought I could have applied for that. I could do that job. You know, and he talks about a jealousy factor. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I agree with it, but his theory was a jealousy factor. And one of the things that they found hard to stomach was the fact that I knew what was going on and frequently wasn't telling them. And I'd been travelling with them to international matches and European matches and the press corps over the previous umpteen years. And suddenly I'm drawn into that position and I'm not telling them stuff that I'm not supposed to tell. And he thought that created an instant...
Well, similar to that, I often wondered also whether... We already had the press on Fergus's
yeah,
back.
On his case, yeah.
But I also wondered whether that then was compounded because their initial thoughts was one of our own's going in, mm-hmm. so we'll actually get more.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they turned against the club even more so because not only were they not getting more of what they wanted, as you just said, the leaks were cut off and they were even getting, so it was a double whammy.
Yep.
They were expecting one of their own being in there and giving a nod and a wink, and it became worse.
Well, there's one other thing, one other aspect to it that was interesting, and that was the fact that I knew all the guys in the media pretty well. Some I knew very well, some I worked with, same paper, you know, so I knew a lot of people very well. And I said to everybody at the start, I actually said at a press conference, listen guys, this is going to be, the dissemination of information at this place is going to be done professionally and properly and courteously and evenly and fairly. I'm not giving exclusives to anybody. Whatever we've got to report and tell will be told to everybody at the same time. So I know all of you pretty well personally. Don't think there's any point in calling me separately to get an edge in terms of information, because that's not going to be available. But nobody is going to miss out on a story though, because there's nobody going to be preferred. So you can relax in the sense that I know the biggest thing that worries a journalist is missing the story.
Mm-hmm.
That's much more important to them than getting one. It's missing one that everybody else gets or somebody else gets. That's serious bad news for the guy. So I said, that's not going to happen. As far as I'm concerned, there's no possibility. Don't worry. Don't go to your bed at night wondering if the next morning's paper's going to, that your paper doesn't have it and they have it. That won't happen. But they didn't believe me. They just didn't trust me, because people don't work that way in football.
Mm-hmm.
That's not how football normally operates. And I said to Fergus at one time, when we were getting slaughtered, of course I was appointed by him, which didn't help me for getting slaughtered. You know, that was it was his boy, and I was his lackey in many people's eyes at the start. So I was bound to take it.
And a guy they all liked in Tommy Burns had just been removed.
Absolutely. Yep. Tommy, a popular guy, had gone. But I said to Fergus at one time, not long after I went in, I said, maybe we should do what David Murray does. And he said, What's that? I said, well, he has a briefing lunch every 2 or 3 months, and he brings in 5 or 6 journalists, and then the following time it's another 5 or 6 journalists, and he has lunch with them and briefs them all, and they're all terrified not to get an invitation, so they won't want to upset him, so they don't upset him.
Mm-hmm.
They don't write anything bad about him, so they want to be at the next briefing lunch. Maybe we should look at this and do something like that. Under no circumstances will I operate like that. You can hear him, can't you?
Yeah.
And you can only admire that.
Yeah.
But that was what David Murray did do, that.
Mm-hmm.
His briefing lunches. And nobody ever criticised David Murray in my time. We were at Celtic together, Fergus and I were, at the time we were together, I don't think there's a word of criticism about David Murray ever. In fact, we kept getting told all the time, just spend the money, Rangers, spend the money, what's wrong with you, just spend the money, you know, all that kind of stuff. He said, well, no, we'll let Rangers do what Rangers do, we'll run this thing properly as we see it, you know, that was the argument. But that didn't go down too well, especially when they weren't getting the briefing lunches.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because I was once told by somebody at Celtic, very same thing, we will never behave like Rangers.
Right.
And have favourites within the press.
Right.
And you get better press by doing it, but we don't think it's the right thing to do and the right way to do business.
That was how it was viewed at that time.
So you came in, you have all of these factors, Fergus McCann. I often wonder whether part of it was those people who were getting the briefing from David Murray were getting briefings about how they should be portraying Celtic and Rangers from mm-hmm. David Murray. Do you have any insight into that?
Well, what I can tell you is there was undoubted agenda among the popular press to the extent that we used to have press conferences, and the press conference would be conducted in normal fashion, and it would end. And you always wait for the last question, which is when you all get up to go away. Somebody, just one last thing. And that was the one that was the killer question, obviously. Mm-hmm. So we got to know that, so you were ready for that. That was fine. So you deal with that. And then where the press room was, I think it still is at Celtic, you could go out and look down to the veranda, down to the central area downstairs, and the huddle would take place.
Mm-hmm.
And the decision would be taken what they're going to write.
Mm-hmm.
And the following day, the batter would come in and they'd all write much the same stuff in similar papers. There were exceptions to that, let me say, but a big number would do that. And it bared no relation at all to what happened at the press conference. And if you complained to one of the papers, they said, but every paper is saying the same thing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, but there's a huddle. No, I don't accept that. I don't accept the huddle. There was a huddle. And one of the things I remember getting invited one time, there's a guy who was an executive at the Daily Record Sunday Mail, mm-hmm. the time where whom I had known for a long time, was a good guy. And he was clearly uncomfortable about the press that Celtic were getting, mm-hmm. and I was getting, and Fergus was getting. And he called me one day and said, I can't stand reading that. I'm so upset with this, because we were in good terms, you know. He said, look, can I do something? Can I facilitate a lunch with the Record editor, the Sunday Mail editor, Fergus, and you, and me? And I'll host it, and we'll see if we can get some sense in this, because I hate all this. He was Celtic supporter to the guy, you know. I hate all this. And I said, well, I'll speak to Fergus about that. I think I'm warm to the idea on one condition, that both these editors acknowledge the fact the huddle takes place. And I explained the huddle to him, which appalled him. He said, come on, it's all terrible, that's what happens. I said, if both the editors acknowledge the fact mm-hmm. the huddle happens, then I will persuade Fergus to come to lunch. He phoned about it for days, they won't accept that. They don't accept the huddle. He said, no lunch then. There's no lunch, and the bullies kept coming.
So you've got not great PR.
Well, let me say that.
The club itself.
Let me say that. I want to qualify that and say the PR, we were getting battered on a regular basis. But the guy in charge of PR mm-hmm. is a man for whom I've got great respect. And I thought he did a terrific job in very trying circumstances. Peter McLean. The job Peter did was amazing, considering what he had to handle. It's a very difficult job again with the board mm-hmm. and with the media and with Fergus, with me, you know, all of us. It was quite remarkable, actually, the job he did. I remember the first day I was there, I arrived in the morning to be announced, and it had leaked just over the weekend. I'd started actually the previous Thursday, but no one knew that. But mm-hmm. but over the weekend, it leaked. It was announced on Monday morning, and I went out the back door to get in the 10 o'clock press thing. So I'm in about 9 o'clock and I'm in, and Peter comes in to tell us how it's all going to happen, all this sort of stuff. He said, have you read the paper this morning? And I said, no, I decided I wouldn't read them. He said, great idea. And I said, well, what's the general tenor? He said, mixed. Now, I hadn't done anything. Mm-hmm. I hadn't done a hand's turn. I hadn't been in the building at all. And the back page of the Daily Record, the banner headline, was two words. Joke Brown. Hadn't done anything. Hadn't even been announced. And they purported to quote one of the Supporters Association officials mm-hmm. who was told, who said, you hear Joke Brown's going to be the general manager? And he said, apparently, he said, that must be a joke, I can't believe it, because he's a blue nose. Mm-hmm. Why was I a blue nose? Because I was a West of Scotland Protestant. Mm-hmm. Therefore, that was the perception.
Yeah.
I mean, utter and total nonsense. You know, they spent the first 3 or 4 days of my existence trying to find somebody in Scotland who could say they had gone to Ibrox with me, or see me wear a scarf, or whatever the hell. I went to great lengths to make an association, not appreciating the fact that I was brought up in a house where my father, who was a professional footballer in his day, and hated both Celtic and Rangers, mm-hmm. having been a player against them, and thought they got all the refereeing decisions and all that stuff, old fashioned stuff. And when I was a very, very small boy, 4, 5, 6, 7 years old, mm-hmm. and watching the football results. If Celtic and Rangers both lost in the same day, which is very unusual, but it happened more often then. If it happened, my father came in and celebrated and brought in all the sweets and the bottles of...
And that's one of the things I was going to say. Part of your... So you have this cascade of problems. The media don't like Fergus, which makes some of the fans start to turn against Fergus very quickly after he comes in. A well-liked manager goes.
Yeah.
You're brought in as general manager. You are portrayed as a football commentator's going to be managing the material at Celtic. Then there was lots of, but you do know this guy's a Rangers fan, just listen to his commentaries.
That's right, that was part of it, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let me tell you about that for me. I had a good one about that. I did a Rangers Celtic match once, and the usual mail would come bouncing in, and I get the most vitriolic letter from a guy who's a Celtic supporter about my Rangers bias. And in the same mail, I get the exact opposite from a Rangers supporter. And I actually photocopied each letter and sent a copy to each to the other, I must be doing okay. But, so that's the perception. You know, that was the perception.
And then you bring in the worst thing to hit your pants since you lost me.
Well, I didn't do that, but I was party to it.
Yeah. So we have Wim Jansen comes in. And
yeah, he was the worst thing that hit since Hiroshima, and that was again partly because of the fact that we hadn't done what most clubs do, which is feed out in advance how good this guy is, who this guy is, and give someone a little story so they start talking about him and build him up. Example: Gerard Houllier. Mm-hmm. A year later.
Yeah.
If you recall, there was a time when it was, he was the guy pointed, yeah, he was going to be the man. Now the truth of that matter is I did speak to Gerard Houllier. Mm-hmm. I met him, and as soon as I met him, he said, look, I must say to you, I'm going to Liverpool, it's done. Mm-hmm. It's a done deal. And I said, oh, okay, but I still want a conversation. I wanted a conversation with him anyway, because one of my briefs also was, and this is one that I didn't agree with, but my instruction was that any head coach had not to be British.
Right.
Absolutely nobody British was going to be considered. Now, I didn't agree with that, but I had to live with that. That's what I was told.
Why was that? Yeah.
Because Fergus's view was that the British were contaminated in terms of the way they operated.
Right, so they wouldn't operate
the
head coach.
They weren't functioning in that particular way. And the first name I gave him that I fancied was British. Mm-hmm. Roy Hodgson, and the big argument I had was he's not British at all anymore because he spent his whole career abroad, so mm-hmm. he's as European as they come, but he's got the great capacity to be British as well, so he covers both angles. No, he's British. It wasn't even a consideration. I don't even think about it. He's just British. He's out of consideration. No possibility of that, which I thought was unfortunate. Anyway, that was a major issue. Mm-hmm. When that was coming up. But when the Jansen thing happened, we should have leaked it out. The Houllier thing, they first of all wrote about Houllier. Someone saw me meeting Houllier, I think, or someone heard about meeting Houllier. So Houllier is the man. And on day one, he was slaughtered for failing to take France to the World Cup in 94. They lost
in
the last 5 minutes to Bulgaria.
Cantona and Chinon.
So, and they're a great bunch of players, and they failed. Yep. They lost 2-0 the last 5 minutes. The last qualifier went out, and he was portrayed in day one as hopeless. But then people did some more homework mm-hmm. over a period of time and discovered, no, he's pretty damn good. So 2 weeks later, I am pilloried for not getting him because he was outstanding. So because they just fed in. They'd all done their homework and they'd all developed the Houllier thing and all that stuff. But Houllier told me in day one, I'm going to Liverpool, and showed me his contract. And I have to tell you, perfectly honestly, if he hadn't committed himself to Liverpool and he had shown me that contract, he wouldn't have been coming to Celtic either. He would have choked an elephant with his contract at Liverpool. There was no possibility. But he had a student at Liverpool. He had a big affiliation with Liverpool. Uh-huh, he wanted to go to Liverpool. He told me he was going as joint manager with Roy Evans, which he did. And I said, that'll never work. I tried to persuade him. I said, that's out of the question. It's no possibility of that working. And he said, we think we can make it work. And I said, that's good. It's one of
the guys
in charge eventually,
yep.
You know, and that happened to be him, so that was all right. But Houllier, that was a great example. He was an idiot the first time he was mentioned because of the Bulgaria game, but within 2 weeks he became the messiah we should have got. Mm-hmm. And we didn't get him. That was another tragedy about when Benglos came in. Gerard Houllier, we've been in touch with Gerard Houllier quite a lot, mm-hmm. Considered him a friend really, and he called me and said, just to let you know, he said, I'm being announced at Liverpool and after the World Cup. Everyone's going after the World Cup. I'm being announced at Liverpool on Thursday. And I said, well, that's great. We're making our announcement on Thursday. And by the way, one of the first guys to promote Benglos was Julie. The matter of interest. So I said, we're announcing same day. And oh, that's ideal, that's fine. But then we had a delay, we had a hiccup. I can't remember what it was at the time, but there was some delay. We delayed 24 hours, which meant that Hooray was announced at Liverpool 24 hours before Benglos was announced at Celtic. And the result of that was that I'm slaughtered in the Friday morning papers for losing Hulier and for having nobody else in sight. And while these papers are percolating, we're calling a press conference for that same day.
Due to the generosity of Jock's time, that's enough for now. And we have a second part of this podcast coming up in the next day or two. That'll be podcast number 210B. Hope you enjoyed what you've listened to so far to date, and I'll return you to Jeff Lynn doing his best I Am a Walrus impersonation. Cheers. This is me, Harry Brady, saying goodnight. Goodnight.